Hi, everybody. My name is Beverly Burnett, and I am a very grateful recovering member of the Flower Mound Awakenings Al-Anon Family Group, newly formed. Oh, it is truly an incredible experience to be here. I agree with Ian that this is one of those God things. You know, when all those kind of things kind of cave in, it's like the domino effect, and this happens. And I was telling him, I normally don't group things that I do too much because my husband is kind of semi-disabled. So I had something going on last weekend that took me out of town, and I have something going on next weekend that'll take me out of town. And this weekend was open. And you know what they say in the program, we never say no to an Al-Anon request. So I go into the kitchen and I said, this young man in Canada would like me to come up there and speak, and it'll be between two weekends gone. I said, what do you think? And he said, you don't have to ask me because you do anything you want to do anyhow. So that was that. So I thought, okay, we don't say no to an Al-Anon request. And in alcoholic, that means go if you want. So, you know, I have an alcoholic interpreter in Southern California. Whenever I don't understand what he's saying, I call my friend Patty and I says, what does this mean when he says it that way? And she says, he's afraid. Or she'll say to me, no, he just wants more of your attention. So she interprets alcoholic for me so that I get it right. You know, this program, I came here and, you know, it says we shouldn't be a glum lot, and I was a glum lot when I got here. I've been in Al-Anon 35 years, and I'm not a sideline person. I am still in the middle of Al-Anon every single, there hasn't been a week in 35 years that I haven't been in at least two meetings of Al-Anon. And I go to open AA meetings, I attend conventions, I sponsor a lot of gals, I have a sponsor, and so I'm like, I'm in the middle of the boat. I am not going to fall off an edge and disappear. And it was really exciting this year to start a new group, to be a part of that, to register the group, to decide how much we were going to pay for rent, because the church says, we don't really want anything. We've wanted an Al-Anon group in our church for years. We are so grateful. Well, we have this seventh tradition that we're self-supporting through our own contributions, so we have to give something. So we came up with an amount, but the reason we left our old group is that the focus was on money, property, and prestige. And it diverted us from our primary spiritual aim, which was to be available and to help the families who were affected by alcoholism. So it was really not a comfortable place for me to be. Besides that, we had a dominant personality. So we had three bangers going on. So when this opportunity came, we did a group vote, and going to the new location got voted down, and the next day, the seven of us who had voted to go said, we can do it anyhow. And I thought, oh my God, that's how it works. So now we have enough money that we get to use our money for the purpose that this very book here was intended, and that was to give them away to newcomers. And boy, does that ever feel good. The books cost about $5.50. We're lucky enough in Dallas that we have a very active LDC, a literature distribution center, and we have a paid employee, and we have volunteers that come and answer the telephone. So we have a really active group there. And so we buy, with our first bit of money that we gathered up, we bought a case of those, and we give our newcomers, if they come twice, we do have a rule, if they come twice, we give them a book. And that feels so good, because even if they don't come back the third time, they have the manual. You know, they've got the book, and they can, you know, and it just feels great. So that's my enthusiasm for 35 years. So I hope that, you know, it's catchy. I want everybody to feel this kind of passion about life and about recovery and about their home group that I feel after all these years. So Anyhow, thank you, Ian, for I don't know if I was first or fourth on the list, but apparently I was God's divine choice, and Ian was the messenger, and here I am. And so thank you, and thank you, Emmett, for being Johnny on the spot. And so I love Canada. I love Canada. I've been here a number of times, and I want you to know now, don't you dare tell anybody in Dallas, but you guys are the nicest people in the whole world. Canadian people love their country, they love their water, they love their people, and they love good food. I get tired of rice and beans. So, lots of rice and beans. So thank you. And I love your title, The Festival. It just makes you feel festive just to have that. You know, there are usually conventions or conferences or retreats, but I love the word festival. So that has really stirred me. So anyhow, I'll tell you a little bit about what I was like. I wasn't always this happy. I was the day I was born, apparently. But after that, it went downhill for a number of years. So I was a happy little kid, and you know, who was affected by alcoholism right from the get-go. I was born in Chicago, Illinois. That's why I sound more like you than them, even though I've lived in Texas almost 40 years. The best I can do is y'all, and it doesn't even sound real anymore. So I'll be talking to somebody, and they'll say, "You're not from Texas. You're from Chicago." And I'd say, "How do you know that?" "Oh, by the way, you say coffee." So... So I give myself away. So I was raised in alcoholism, and I have said that all along. I felt like the effects of alcoholism were like the tentacles of an octopus. They just were entangled around. But also I learned in this program from going, you know, to open meetings and working with sponsors that you weren't allowed to call anybody an alcoholic unless you knew for sure they were alcoholic. Now, I really felt like I was raised up in really significant alcoholism. But about a year ago, I'm cleaning out my house. I have reached the age where you start to give it away rather than accumulate. So I'm cleaning out my house, and I found a box, and I opened up the box. And in the box was all of my dad's personal papers. My father died in 1990, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. And in that box was love letters that he wrote to my mom and cards that my mom wrote to him and their wedding certificate and their death certificate, you know, dad's death certificate was in there and other significant things. And a lot of the little letters, I sat there and I read it. I almost felt like I was peeking into their real personal life. But my mom died in 1978 and my dad in 90, so it wasn't like really that bad. But there were letters that were, "We've all got them. Please, please, honey, I'll never do it again. Just let me come home. We can start all over again." You know, those kinds of letters. And I thought, wow. That sounds like alcoholism to me. And it wasn't just one or two, it was several. And then I came across some paperwork that said that my dad was in the Santa Barbara, California jail for drunk driving when he was 65 years old. He spent the night, his brand new Lincoln Town Car was impounded. He spent, I don't know, $35 or $40 to get it out of impound back then. He had a fine. And he was on 2 years probation. Do you think I knew anything about that? No way. So I thought to myself, I was sitting there and I almost felt a sense of joy. And I thought, I really did get raised up in an alcoholic home. It was real. And here I am, 34 years in the program, and still wondering if it was really alcoholism. It was. I identify with everything I've heard. This weekend, it's been wonderful, wonderful recovery, and you have given me so much about what it was like and how you are today. It's just been a magnificent weekend, and I've attended everything that you had. So I came from an alcoholic home. My mom was deeply affected by the disease of alcoholism. She was raised in alcoholism. my grandfather died, her father died at an early age, and in my purse that's sitting right there on the floor is a tiny little leather coin purse with one of those little button openings that pops open. And in that purse, originally when I got custody of it, there was a couple of corroded pennies and a corroded dime and a nickel. And my mom said that that was all the money that my grandfather had in his possession on the day that he died. And inside of there was an obituary that was just this much. And it had his first and last name, and the day he was born, and the day he died. And that's alcoholism. There was nothing else in there about any of his accomplishments or what he had done or how many children, just this little thing, and that he was married to Mary Kochel. You know, and you know, that was sad. So I carry that little thing, not just because it's the old leather and it's such a precious little thing you don't have anymore. So my dad was also raised up in alcoholism, and they had a little meat market in on 26th Street in Chicago. And, you know, it was all about drinking. My dad's brother's name was Jimmy. And when I was a little kid, a lot of the focus of my early childhood was not only on where they were going to drink, what they were going to drink, what holiday is coming up, you know, how much is there, who's all coming, you know, oh, thank God somebody died, we can have a funeral now, and, you know, somebody's getting married, we're going to go to the VFW, we're going to do this. I don't remember much about my childhood that did not have something to do with the anticipation of where they were going to drink, how much they were going to drink, and how drunk they were going to get. And I remember a lot of drunken parties in our little house. I remember drunken parties in the backyard. And my dad and a bunch of the neighbors were building a boat in the garage next door. And there was always this big galvanized tub of ice, and the kids got to do the ice pick, and nobody was ever allowed in that garage because, you're not allowed to come in the garage, you know. Out of the garage, but we could do the ice. And so one day they announced that they were building a boat, and it was supposed to go into Lake Michigan. And one day they announced that the boat was done. They had sanded and polished, and that we got to see the boat. It was absolutely, it looked like, if you watch NCIS, that guy that is always building the boat in his garage and or in his basement, and somebody, one of the characters, said to him last week, how are you going to get this out of there? And then the show was over. Well, that's kind of the way that it was with Ollie's garage. It was like, you know, there's the boat. Well, they didn't realize it, but they had built the boat much bigger than the garage door. So I'm absolutely sure if you go to 2829 South St. Louis that there is a boat in a garage somewhere. So my Uncle Jim was a drunk, and he was, when you talked about alcoholism to me when I was new in the program, because I didn't know alcoholism, alcoholic, Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, those were words that I had never heard until I came to you, I came to you because of God's grace. That's everybody sitting here is here because of God's grace. And the action that you took to stay in the middle of this profoundly beautiful program. But I never heard those words. So my Uncle Jim, they would call my dad from 26th Street, and they would say to my dad, Jimmy's bad drunk, and you need to come and get him because he's going to die. Now, my uncle looked like alcoholism. He looked like a drunk, you know, some kind of a crappy hat that he picked up out of somebody's, you know, garbage can, and that old trench coat that had stains and holes in it, you know, from cigarette burns and all that. And his fingers, I remember him like it was yesterday. Every bit of the tips of his fingers were stained brown from tobacco, and his fingernails would be so long they would grow over the tips of his fingers and smell. Oh, my God, that man smelled terrible. And my dad would go and get him, and my mom would put newspaper on the seat of the car so my dad could put him in there, you know, and bring him. And they Cloroxed him before they bathed him. And then my dad would get some clothes together, and they would take him to the VA hospital. And he would sober up, and they'd get him a job. He was supposedly a master butcher, and he would get a job. Somebody, when he was sober, they all wanted him. You know, everybody would give him a job, but the problem is he had alcoholism. And you know, sobering up at the VA hospital is not a cure for alcoholism, the disease. And so it wouldn't be long until it started again. And I remember they brought him back to our house over and over and over until one day my mom said, "Don't ever bring him here again. I'm done." And I remember that like if it was yesterday. I'm done. I don't want him here anymore. He smells, he's dirty, he's not going to stay sober. I'm done. And so that's how it was. When I was 7 years old, I was an only child until I was seven. And my grandmother lived with us 6 months out of the year. And she lived with my mom's brother 6 months out of the year because my grandfather died at an early age of alcoholism and she didn't even have a home or enough money to support herself that she could live alone. She altered tuxedos for a tailor. And I would remember walking with my grandmother, and she was little tiny. She was only under 5 feet tall. And she had a wire basket, and she'd put all those altered tuxedos in there. And we'd walk down to 26th Street, and she would exchange them out. And she did that week after week, and she hand-sewed most of those alterations. And you know, made little pocket change probably back in those years. But my dad went to war, to World War II, and my mom went to work. She supposedly was making, I don't know, B-something bombers. But I think there was a lot of, according to these letters, there was more going on than her making. She was making more than B-17 bombers. According to the letters. And my grandmother took care of me. My mother had rage. And when you're living in active alcoholism, and it is a family disease and it's progressing, what ends up happening is that there's a food chain to where the rage goes. And I was the recipient of my mom's rage. My mom and dad fought a lot, but any of the residual anger would come out on me. And my grandmother, when she was with us during those 6 months, she would protect me from my mother, and she would say to her, "Sylvie, don't hit her. Sylvie, leave her alone." You know, my mother would then come and whisper to me, and she said, "You wait until your grandmother goes home. You'll pay," basically. And I did. You know, I was afraid. And some days, you know, it's been talked about, some days everything's good. You're walking, you know, on the sunny side of the street, and you get a little attention from the family, and the next day everything's changed, and you never know which day is which. And I never knew if I was going to get kissed or beat up. And that's how it was. When I was seven, my sister was born, and I took exception to that. I don't have words to say that I'm jealous. I'm afraid. Are you going to still love me? Will Grandma love me? You know, do I get to live here too? You know, can two kids live in this house? I have all these questions, and I don't know how to ask them. So what I do is, as my sister grew up just a tiny bit, I started picking on her. Because my anger and my fears and everything, I had to have somewhere to put that, so my sister got it. 2 weeks ago, we went to the state fair together, and we decided to take the train, and it was a wonderful day. And I called the little train line, the commuter train, and I says, "I don't know how to read all those diagrams on the computer. Will you tell me what train to take?" And so the lady was kind enough to plan our little trip to go from Louisville to the state fair. And my sister's sitting out on the platform, and the lady asks her, "Are you two related?" And she said, "She's my older sister." And anyhow, somehow or other, it came out. She says, "This is the first time that we've ever done anything together in a long time." And she says, "I'm so excited." And the lady said, "Why, do you live apart?" "No, we live pretty close together, and we're really good friends. We just don't do much together." And the lady said, "Well, that's a shame." And I said, "Well, it's taken a little while to get this relationship patched up, because," I says, "I just was not a very nice sister." And then my sister pops up, and she goes, "And she wasn't." So anyhow, so if you want to ever give her a call, she'll give you the real lowdown on me. So I had all these feelings of fear and, you know, being displaced out of the family or whatever. 3 years later, my brother was born, and I had no, he just was born. We were living out through the tail end of the Depression, so money was a god, and there was a lot of fear around that. I mean, the people in our neighborhood didn't have anything. They were kind of rising up from the ashes of nothing. And so it's been said, we were supposed to be seen and not heard. I was not allowed to bring children into the house, any of my playmates home, because they were dirty. And, you know, we had paste waxed floors and plastic over the sofas, and everything was in order, so I couldn't. But my feeling was I didn't want anybody there, not because of that, but because I never knew if my mom was going to start screaming. So I always went other places. Now, when you're young and you're feeling like that, and you go into somebody else's home, and then you think, why is it different here? What's different about the house next door or the friends down the street? I never knew what was different. But we got to enjoy being in the house, play on the piano, play some games. You know, we've got some leftover roast beef. We're all having, hot roast beef sandwiches. Do you want to stay? It was such a delight for me to be invited to stay in somebody else's home for a meal where they didn't bang their fist on the kitchen table and the kids were, all going like this. And it was just, it was such a feeling of, but I didn't know what was different until I got into the program and I started to listen to your stories. So my Uncle Jim ended up dying after we left Chicago and went into the suburbs. My mom thought if we left Chicago and went into Westmont that was going to be the cure for alcoholism. And then we were in Westmont until I was a senior in high school, and then my dad got a chance to have a really super-duper job in Ogden, Utah, and so we moved across the Rocky Mountains to Ogden, Utah, and that absolutely was going to be the cure for alcoholism. But the fact is, alcoholism is a disease, and it continues to progress, and it continues to deeply affect the people in the family. And nothing really changed from Chicago to Westmont. My mom still screamed out the windows, and her and my dad still fought, and I still found comfort. By then, I'm growing into teenage, and I was allowed to go into the youth center and, listen to the rock and roll music and dance with the boys and, wear the Levi's with the little red tag and saddle shoes and all that stuff. There was a show on television that was called American Bandstand, and we had idols on that show. And I know that I'm speaking to people, most of you are like going to go to sleep here in a minute, but it's my life. And the AA speaker today said that, that he had taken his son to a meeting in the Al-Anon spoke, and he was glad that she wasn't old and had blue lips. And I thought, well, thank you. Because you don't get 35 years in recovery without getting old. Hello. So I am that. So, my mom kept thinking that if we just did this, and if we just got that, and if she had a diamond, and my dad, if he had some shoes, and, all these things, what ifs, it was going to change. But alcoholism is a disease, and nothing changes it except the spiritual life. And, there's just no other cure for it. And it is contingent on the maintenance of your spiritual program that we get to stay here every day. You just don't get it, and then everything's fine. It takes work to stay in recovery for 35 years and start to recover from these deep tentacles that, have permeated every cell of our body if we've been born in it. So anyhow, there was a lot, but my mom thought moving cured alcoholism, so we did it. So we get to Utah, and it was the same. It was just exactly the same. My dad met that train, and he was drunk, and it started all over again. So when I turned 18, my high school life in Utah was horrible. I turned 18, my dad got me a job where he worked, and I met this. Well, I wasn't there, I don't know, not very long, when this guy walks in, and oh my God, I hadn't seen a crew cut in a year. I mean, a real live man with a crew cut, and this guy had a crew cut and a ducktail, and he smoked, which was kind of a prerequisite to the fox, and he'd have a toolkit in one hand and his cigarette hanging out of his mouth and a sport coat and a tie. He'd reach in his pocket, get this brush, and he'd brush that crew cut and stand it straight up. And I'm like, oh my God, this is way too much for an 18-year-old kid. I'm like, whoa. But I found out he was married. And he He was married, but they said about 6 months, and he's not happy. It seems like he keeps sleeping in his office. And so we don't know what's going on there, but it's not good. And I would think, oh, man, if he was mine. And here's another little thing. We don't have a clue, but I would think to myself, if he was mine, I could make him happy. Now, I don't even know how to make myself happy. I don't even know what sex is. I'm 18 years old, and I thought you got pregnant kissing. I mean, that's how ignorant I was about even, you know, it was pretty amazing. Anyhow, I learned quick. I followed directions. Last week, I was at the airport, and the lady who was picking me up says, I drive a blue Chevy Cruze. Now, I'm in Detroit. Did you know that everybody in Detroit drives a blue Chevy Cruze? Because they make them there. So I get out, and she says, I'll be right outside the door of American Airlines, and I'm in a blue Chevy Cruze. Just hop in. So I come out the door with my little purple bag, and I hop in a blue Chevy Cruze and scared the daylights out of some lady. And I said, are you Chris? And she goes, no. And her eyes were like this big. I says, I am so sorry. I thought, thank God I was a woman, or you could have shot me. Who, you know, she maybe had a right to conceal. I don't know. So then the real Chris showed up, and I told her what I did. And I said, you know what? I was taught in Al-Anon to follow direction. And I says, you know, if you tell me get in a blue Chevy Cruze, by God, I'm going to get in a blue Chevy Cruze. So anyhow, so this guy and I, we dated for a year and a week, and all of the signs and symptoms of alcoholism in its progressed stages were apparent. To anybody else out there, they were apparent. He missed dates, and I would get that phone call the next day. Now, this was after a whole night of torturing myself, that I was not skinny enough, that my hair wasn't the right color, that my mom surely said something ugly to him. You know, what's wrong with me? Everything. I picked apart, you know, my hair, my face, my body. Everything was wrong with me on the outside. Because this guy doesn't show up for a date. Now, he calls me up, and he says, I went into the Keg. Now, the Keg was an army barracks with a half of a wood floor and a half of a dirt floor, and they had pickled eggs on the counter and, you know, those little sausages that a lot of guys call dinner, and or mom. And Mary and Bill looked like Ma and Pa Kettle. And they would be, he would call me and say, I don't know what happened. Next thing I knew, it's 1 o'clock in the morning and Mary and Bill are kicking us out. I don't know what happened. I am so sorry, and I'll never do it again. And do you know what? Those are absolute promises that they mean to keep. But I didn't know that for many years in recovery. I didn't know. I don't know what happened. I don't know where I was. I don't know where it went. I don't know where I parked it. And at the time that I feel, the big book tells me that, you know, they have this sense of incomprehensible demoralization. You know, he wants to make it to pick me up for a date, and he's at the Keg, and he's getting thrown out. He was supposed to only have one beer. And I'll never do it again. At that moment, at 8 or 9 o'clock the next morning, he meant that with everything he had inside of him. But he did it over and over and over. And I don't have a spiritual life. I don't have a God. I don't have steps. I don't know what's wrong. I don't know anything about alcoholism. And I think there's something wrong with me. And each time that I would feel like there was something wrong with me, I mean, my mom had beat me up. You know, I was tall. I took off after my dad's people. My mom was little, so they made fun of my size. I had measles when I was a kid, and I wore big, thick glasses, you know, and so they called me Four Eyes. You know, there were all these things. And so I didn't need alcoholism to feel even worse about myself. This started, you know, early on when I was just a little girl, you know, so I didn't need help with feeling bad about myself. So I, we ended up, of course, I married him. he was too cute to let go. He still is. He's so anyhow, we got married, and I had a baby nine months and 2 days after we were married. Now, I had birth control pills in my purse. I thought that that was good enough. It's not. Gotta swallow them down. So we got married on a Saturday night in our house, in my mom's house, and they had a lot of liquor down there. I got married on November 11th, 1961, and in another week and a half, I'll be married 55 years to the same guy. So I've been married longer than Ian is old, and most of you. It's hard for me to wrap my brain around the fact that I have a 54-year-old son. I feel like 25 inside of me. I feel young and springy and spry, and that's all because of recovery. You know, we get ourselves back, and we have so much living to do after all the years of that deep darkness that we lived in. And I really do live in the sunlight of the Spirit today, and every day, really, truly, each day is a new beginning for me. And I live like that. I live in gratitude today. I live in grace. I don't take 1 minute of this program for granted, because I know I am here by the grace of God, and I know that the reason I stay is because I've been willing to follow direction and get in a blue Chevy Cruze. And I've done that for 35 years. So, you know, we were married on a Saturday. Monday, we both go back to work, and he doesn't come home. I've made a tuna casserole, and he doesn't come home. So I made one phone call, and I asked him when he'd be home, and he said he would be home in a little while, dear. I love you. About 30 minutes later, see, I don't know when to stop. I don't have a stop button. And so I call him again, and the voice changes, and he says, it'll be a little longer. I love you. And the third time I call, he said, I told you I'd be there. And know I love you. And by the fourth time, you know, it's like, don't call again. And I can feel it, that feeling. You know what I'm talking about, that feeling of despair, of desperation, of, oh, my God, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, what have I done? And so he showed up, you know, and I was happy to see him. I mean, what are we, not even married 3 days? And it already reared its ugly head in our home. And then I find out I'm pregnant, and I have a baby I don't know how to take care of. I wasn't the kind of a little kid who liked little kids. I liked to go out and hang from monkey bars and ice skate and stuff. That looked like work to me. So that's kind of, you know, and it went on. 2 years later, I had my second child, Scott, and my husband went up the corporate ladder. His alcoholism was progressing, but more so my disease was progressing. And I was raised by a mother who, you know, hit and slapped and punched and called you names and stuff, and I made a promise I'd never do that. And without you, I don't know how not to. And so I found myself in a position one day where I had my oldest son, who was still in a diaper, so he was under two, and I was restless that day in hall, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, probably, you know, focused on him. That baby did something that probably all babies do, probably took a pot out of the cabinet or some little run a Tonka truck over my newly vacuumed rug, whatever it was, and I went into my rage, which I have rage, and I grabbed him and a spoon, and I start to beat him. And anybody in this room who has that kind of rage knows you don't have a stop button on that. Once it comes up, it's like trying to put the pin back in the grenade. There is no coming back from that. And I know I heard the voice of God say, if you hit him again, you'll kill him. And I remember dropping both of them just like that. And I made some kind of a promise to myself that I'd never do it again. Now, to my knowledge, I never again hit my kids, never. But I did things that were far worse. You know, that demoralizing, you're dumb, you're stupid, get back here, put my finger, you know, pull your hair, you know, all those other things. So I could always say I never hit my kids, but I did stuff to them that was far worse. So my husband was up the corporate ladder, and we were we moved from Utah, and we went to Pennsylvania, and there was a little respite in the alcoholism in Pennsylvania. We got a snowmobile, and it was a snowy year. For the next 3 years, snowy. We had a lot of fun. He was coming home from work on time. The drinking seemed to be curbed a little bit. We were hanging out with the neighbors who were really family-oriented people. They were all Smiths, and they all had snowmobiles, and it was just a lot of fun. Saturday night was girls' night out, and it was just the guys and the girls, and we got babysitters, and Wednesday night was guys' night out, and then Friday night was family night, or Sunday was family day, and we'd go sit in the mountains somewhere and get a big jug of chili and some hot chocolate, and it was really fun. And then he got transferred to New Jersey, and it was like it's like the guy in the big book who thought that, he could put a little scotch in his milk and it wouldn't count. And I can see it. I look back at it now, and I almost let my breath out in those 2 years that we had that snowmobile and life seemed good. I could almost feel like I went, and then I watched it start all over again. And it was Katie bar the door. That alcoholism started up exactly where it had left off, and it was bigger and more. And it's confusing. It's confusing. You think, well, how can it be like that there and then all of a sudden this? And so we were there for 5 years. The day before we moved from New Jersey, we lived on a private lake. In Sparta, New Jersey, and we had Little Lake Mohawk, and it was a private lake. And I lived one house, one row up from the lake, and I hear a knock on my door, and I've got everything packed and cleaned. I've toothbrushed everything. You know how we are. It's got to be perfect. And so my neighbor says, come with me. I want you to come with me. And I says, I can't. My God, I've got a lot of work to do. And she goes, no, you're coming with me. So she puts me in her car. We go down to the lake. She takes two lawn chairs and puts them out on this little dock. She's got a thermos of coffee and two mugs. And she said, sit here. And I want you to look out at all this, because she said, you've been here almost 5 years, and I don't think you ever once took the time to see where you lived. And that was a sad moment. 5 years of my life just erased, But it wasn't just that 5 years. It was many years where I would hide in fantasy. This book has a wonderful little chapter in it that says, struggling with reality. I mean, I was never in reality. I was always in a fantasy life someplace. So we ended up in Texas, and we had two full-blown alcoholic teenagers. They were 14 and 16 years old. And God came and got me through a coworker. Her name was Margaret. She had not been in work for a couple of days. And when she came to work, I said, where have you been? And she said, my son almost died of alcoholism this weekend. And she said it was really touch and go for a while. And we sat down for lunch, and she started to tell me. I says, what does alcoholism look like? What is it? And she started to tell me about the things that her son was doing that she was aware of in this brief little time. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I promise you, what God did for me that day was to take the scales off my eyes, pull that back, and I get to take a look at my life, these kids, the stealing, the lies, the way their complexion had changed, the way their wardrobes had changed, the way their bedrooms were a mess, and the kids, and all, the pills in the washing machine, and the shut doors, and the lying, and I mean, I saw all of it for just a minute, just like that. But if you see that and you don't have program, that'll scare the daylights out of you. They say before you die, your life flashes before you. Well, I'm telling you what, when Margaret was telling me about her son, Tim, my life of alcoholism flashed in front of me, and it scared the daylights. Boy, did that close up. But I was smart enough, and this is the divine grace, I was smart enough to say to Margaret, can I have the phone number to that place? And she gave me the phone number to the Westgate Treatment Center. And I called my husband, and I said, with all that's been going on in the house, I think we might have some alcoholism, or at least whatever it is that is wrong with Margaret's son, Tim. And I says, I'm going to call them, and I'd like to go in and see them. you know. So he's like, blah, 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 and I hung up the phone, and I did it. Now, I don't know where I get that. I called Westgate, and I said, can we come? So they set up an appointment, and all four of us went there, and we were evaluated by the whole team, and one at a time, and they sent us home and said, we don't know who has alcoholism. So when you figure out who needs to be here, bring him or her back. But this family is deeply affected by alcoholism. So much so, now these are my own words, so much so that that team of specialists in a treatment center doesn't know which one of us to keep. That's pretty bad. And I was offended because I wasn't drinking. And I was the keeper of the key. I was the keeper. My friend Babs that has passed away, she was the keeper of the fly. She says every time her husband got drunk, which was often every day, she said she would look down there and his fly had opened. She was always zipping up his fly. So I was like, I can promise you I didn't care. I thought if that's the way what it ends up, you know, but I was the keeper of the key. And my life got small. My life was so small. I wasn't going anywhere. I had no social engagements with any friends. I had no friends. I mean, their lives were brilliant. They were out there doing whatever they do. My life got small. My life got angry. I was resentful. I hated everything. I was negative about everything. And one of those things about me today is that I still have to work really hard to not go to the dark place first. You know, if anything goes on, my default reaction is to go to the darkness first and say no, that, you know, and force myself over into the light always, to stay in the bright light that it's going to be okay. So that was somewhere around the end of January of 1981, and by the ninth day of February of 1981, my son took something, and I admitted him. He called me from school, and he says, "I'll go." But it was either treatment or go to jail, so he didn't have a good motive. I got there, and they said, "You go to Al-Anon," and I says, "I can't. I work." And she says, "Well, so do we. But if you don't go to Al-Anon, you can't come back here." So I went to Al-Anon, and my motive wasn't pure. My son got out of treatment on March 8th of 1981, and by that time I was going to 8 to 10 meetings of Al-Anon and open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week. I was hooked. I was hooked. Now, I'm here to tell you that for the first year, I was in the fellowship. And there is a huge difference between being in the fellowship and being in the program. But I needed the fellowship. I needed coffee and pie at JoJo's. I needed to feel like somebody cared about me. You know, I was in a nest of recovery that was unbelievable. We had, we went to a group that studied the AA 12 and 12 men and women. The women were all Al-Anons. The guys were all alcoholics. And every other Thursday, we went to somebody's house and we studied a tradition or a step out of the AA 12 and 12. And then afterwards, you know, there was coffee and all this fellowship. I needed that. But what happens is alcoholism is a disease. When we got out of treatment on the 8th of March, my husband had already taken a desire chip. So his 35th Al-Anon birthday was February 23rd of this year. By March 30th, I noticed that our oldest son was drinking. And it was a Sunday morning. We're going off to the Alpha Group, and he came in from a night stalker job at the grocery store. And I looked at him, and I said, "Oh, my God, Stephen, you're drunk." And Scott said, "He's worse than me." And I went, "Wow." Now, we go to the meeting, the open AA meeting on Sunday morning at the Alpha Group, and I go to somebody, and I say, "What do I do now?" So I'm not in the program very long, but already I'm beginning to trust you. I already know in that short period of time that you don't tell me what you think I ought to be doing. You say, "This is my experience." And it gave me the opportunity to trust you and love you and have this sense of belonging. So they scripted me. Bill scripted me. This is what you do. And he told me I could ask my son to leave. And I said, God, Billy's only 17 and a half years old. He said, yeah, but if he's an alcoholic and he's in a sober home, he doesn't have the privilege and the right to live there. I didn't know that. I did not know that. So I went home armed with Bill's courage. And when Stephen got up around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I didn't know they got up. He came out of a blackout. I learned a lot. He came out into the kitchen, and I said, I've got something to tell you. You can either come to Alcoholics Anonymous with us tomorrow, or you have to leave. And boy, did he sober up in a hurry. Leave? Whoa, that's a lot, Mom. You don't really mean that. Oh, yeah, I do. And then Bill said, don't give him a lot of time. I said, you have 2 days to make the decision. If you don't come with us to Alcoholics Anonymous tomorrow night, then you have to be out of here by Tuesday. Tuesday? I said, yeah, you got a pickup truck. You can throw all your crap in there and go live with your friends. And I think because I wasn't upset, I wasn't screeching, that he knew I meant it. And he was like, whoa. So he pulls out of the driveway to go to work, and he called me from work, and he said he'd go to one meeting. So that night we're getting in the car, and we're going to the meeting, and my husband looks at my son in the rearview mirror, and he says, I'm not taking this kid to AA dressed like that. And he's got on a Coors hat and a tequila T-shirt, and he's got holy jeans and titty shoes and earrings, and his hair is permed big. And you know, he says, we're going to turn around, and he's going to change his clothes. And the young one says, Dad, we don't have time. You know, we don't have time. Just go. And my husband says, I'm not going to Alcoholics Anonymous with the kid dressed like that. And my husband got out of the car. And he walked home. Now, I got out of the car because I'm going to follow him, and the car is left on this busy street, okay? So, and my son rolls down the window, and he goes, Mom, get in the car and drive. We're going to be late to the meeting. And I said, but what about Dad? And he says, he's a child of God. I did not see that quality in him at that time. So I get in the car and drive us to Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, and I walk in the front door, and Millie says to me, who's that? And I said, that's Stephen. She says, yeah, who is he? And I said, well, he's my oldest son. And, you know, she's an old West Texas girl, and they don't mince words. And she said, he's half dead. And so I said, oh, you know, wow. And she said, you go in that Al-Anon room and we'll take care of him, Bobby. And she summoned her, you know, she has her people. And so she summons Bobby. And so I go get coffee, and I'm just about to go into the Al-Anon door, and the AA door is like, there's just a little wall partition this much. And the door was open a little, like, you know, to peek. So I'm in there, and they had started the meeting, and they said, is there anybody here that would like one day of sobriety? And I watched my young son nudge my older son, and my older son got up there, and he took that hat off, and his head slumped down. He said he was Stephen, and he was alcoholic. And my son has been sober ever since that day, 35 years. So I got to see alcoholism. My son, Stephen, he hooked on to Alcoholics Anonymous. He knew he was drowning. He knew, 17 and a half years old, and he knew he was dying from alcoholism. And I got to watch him go to, you know, meetings, and Bobby's taking him off to the 24-hour club, and I don't know how to mind my own business. I'm saying, you know what, Bobby, he's just a cute little boy. He looked a lot like you, just adorable. I says, Bobby, he's so cute. And now he's cute. You know, he's got on his little button-down blue shirt, and he looks really cute. And Bobby's taking him into the worst part of Dallas you could ever imagine, the 24-hour club. And I said to Bobby, you know what? I don't think it's a really good idea that you take Stephen down there into that neighborhood with those people at midnight for a candlelight recovery meeting. And Bobby, oh, my God, he just poked me right in the chest, and he said, you know what? If he doesn't stay sober, he'll be lucky if he could be a resident there. So, you know, they just weren't nice to us back then. Now we're so afraid. We're so afraid of hurting people's feelings. You know, we don't want to make them mad. We don't want to drive them away. I'm telling you what, they told me the truth and they scared the daylights out of me, and I loved them even more for being honest. I was sitting in a meeting one day, and I was always a nervous wreck, and I'm just picking at my face, and some alcoholic lady slapped my hand and she says, "Quit that." You know, can you imagine doing that to somebody today? That would be called child abuse and you'd be in jail. So anyhow, that's how it was. You know, come with us, be with us, be a part of us. So Steve's setting off into the sunset of sobriety, having fun. He's traveling to Icky Paw and Yucky Paw and doing all kinds of the paws and just, you know, the 24-hour club and a meeting in the morning, a meeting at night. He does a fifth-step inventory. He decides to go to college. He was afraid. And he got admitted to Texas A&M, but he was afraid of that. So he started out at Brookhaven, and he got a two-year associate's degree. I think it's a two-year degree associate's? And then he went off 5 years of Texas A&M University and graduated from there and walked out of there with a job that he still does the same thing today. He loves what he gets to do, and he's sober today. But that didn't make his life perfect. See, that's where we sometimes get caught up. Oh, we're in recovery now. You know, life can't touch us. We're in this beautiful bubble, and everything's going to be wonderful. Well, I'm telling you what, it hasn't been. It hasn't been. The hardest things that I have had to walk through, I've had to walk through in recovery. But the good news is that I never had to walk alone for the most part. So when I had to end up finally putting my youngest son out in the street at 17 and a half years old, that's when I started to work a program. I mean, that's when I really got into the steps. I am powerless over this. And if I even let my mind go where this kid had to live and how he had to survive out there in the street, it would make me absolutely insane, just like the second step. And I was having a hard time coming to believe in God. I wanted to get married in the Catholic Church, and things didn't work out right. And it was strongly suggested that I go find me a nice Catholic boy. And when I walked out of there, I threw away the church and I threw away God. And I was a kid. I have this big memory. I'm dyslexic. I was diagnosed at 60 years old. And I have this big brain. It's like Mensa up there. I mean, I memorize stuff, and I have 5% comprehension. So it's hard for me to read, like, and comprehend. So even reading our daily readings is hard for me to remember what I've read. But then I found out that you all read the page and don't remember it either. So so I thought, okay, it doesn't matter whether you've got 5% comfort. We're all just, like, brain dead. So we're fine, you know, just as long as you do it. Just as long as you do it. And now I have this magical little iPod, and I can take notes on that thing. And I've got 12 daily readers on my iPod. So I can take God with me everywhere I go. You know, I have the daily word comes, not the daily word, God calling comes up on my iPod. And, you know, it's just magical. Electronics is magical, you know, what we can do these days. And so I had to put Scott out, and I get deeply engrossed in the program, and I don't know where to find God. And for a very long time, I walked around saying, "God, I don't know who you are. I don't know where to find you. What am I going to do? The steps are full of God, 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 God of higher power, God, God. I can't stay. And if I can't stay, what am I going to do? What am I going to do?" And I'm doing this. I didn't know I was praying. I did not know I was praying. In one of the daily readers that's not conference approved, it says that God hears the prayers of the heart over the choirs of angels. And I knew when I was saying, "God, I don't know where to find you. I do not know where to find you." He revealed himself to me in a way that I could see it. I could see it. I lost a check, and a person that I worked with in the bank found it in Walmart, and I had signed it. And she called me and she said, "Did you lose something?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "I can't believe you signed a check and then lost it." And I said, "Well, I can't believe you found it. I mean, what are the odds?" And I literally slid down my kitchen cabinet that day, and I thought to myself, "Oh my God, that was so personal. God knows my name." And so I began. I thought, there is a God there. And that was my own personal miracle with my name on it. And time went on, and I'm going to meetings, conferences. My husband lost his job. He was diagnosed in 85 with COPD, and And, you know, lots of things began to happen. My dad came to live with us in 88. He was dying of multiple myeloma. I got to do an eighth and a ninth step with my dad and practice the principles in all my affairs with my dad and create the most loving, absolutely wonderful relationship as we were driving to radiation and chemotherapy. And one day he says to me, I just hate that you have to drive me every Tuesday to one of these crazy treatments. And with all my heart in the right place, I said, I can't think of anything I'd rather be doing. And I am the most selfish, self-centered me person. I want it my way. And I was willing to give up every Tuesday to take care of my dad. And we laughed together and we cried together. And they just loved us for chemotherapy. We'd get the coffee pot going. And, you know, it was fun to be with him. I knew I was about to lose him, but we had a good time. We took him to AA meetings. I mean, what else are you going to do? He'd come home from an AA meeting. He'd say to us, you know, we just... Want to come? Sure. They're going to speak. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll go. Covered dish. Sure, I'll go. And he'd come home and he'd go, God, Pigeon, I love those people. And it never came out of my mouth. And I'd say, that's because those are your people. So one day we come back and I said to him, we gave him a magazine and had a frosty drink. And I says, wow, I don't drink. In honor of sobriety, I don't drink. It's my personal choice. I have not had a drink of alcohol in 35 years. And anyhow, I said to my dad, boy, doesn't that look good? And he goes, you know what? Ever since I've been on this morphine, I haven't really wanted to drink. So that was another clue. So my dad passed away, but when I got my dad in 1988, here's where I really, 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 really found the program, and it's going to be hard for you to believe. My dad came to live with us in September of 1988, dying of multiple myeloma. The middle of October of 1988, my son called from Florida and said he was in full-blown AIDS and he was going to die. They had given him less than a year to live. And anybody who's got a little age in this program knows that in 1988, there wasn't much hope for anybody with AIDS. It was a death sentence. And it was a secret, and it was ugly, and it was horrible. And the medications were primitive at best. And then the dog wasn't feeling good. I took her to the vet, and the vet says, I'm going to give her one more shot in her hips. And after this, if she goes down again, we have to put her to sleep. And I called my sponsor that day, and I said, there is no God. You guys have been promising me since 1981 that God will never give us more than I can handle. My dad is going to die. My son just called and said he has AIDS. He's got a six-month-old baby, and he's going to die before she's a year and a half old, and I've got to put my dog to sleep. There is no God. And you know what she said to me, and she'll agree with this today because we still talk about it. I say to her, how did you know? And she goes, it's the way it is when you're on the phone and you hear somebody in such desperation, the only thing that you can do is allow God to speak through you. And let God, and God spoke through that lady that day and said, at the top of your journal page, I want you to write the evidence of God every day. And I started writing in a journal in 1981. Gene Coffin at the treatment center talked about the importance of writing in a journal. And I wrote in a journal for 33 years, every single day. Now I have a little journal. It's a 5-year journal with only 6 lines. I've written it all out. I don't need a lot anymore. It's all out. But I did that. And she's at the top of that page, I want you to write down the evidence of God. And I screamed at her. I said, did you not hear me? My son's dying, my dad's dying, and I've got to put the dog down. And she said, yes, and God will be with you every step of the way. Every single day, she says, in the Lord's Prayer, it says, give us this day our daily bread. She said, do you know what daily bread is? She says, that is the evidence of God every day. She said, God didn't give them manna for a week. They only gave them what they needed right this minute. Now, it's really hard to comprehend that when you are in the midst of that and thinking, oh, my God, I'm looking at the whole picture, my life. But she's brought it into just right now. She says, Beverly, look at your shoes right now while you're talking to me. Look at your shoes. And right there, right now, where you're standing, everything's okay. Your dad's alive. Your son's alive. The dog is still alive today. And she says, and you and I are talking about the evidence of God. It doesn't get any better than that. And I still got off the phone thinking to myself, that woman is nuts. That woman is out of her mind. But I am here to tell you that that day made me stronger in my spiritual life than anything else could have possibly made me. It forced me to stay in the moment, let go and let God just for today. You know, all of these little things that we learn in this program, it forced me to put all those things into practice on a daily basis. And I'm here to tell you that I got my daily bread every single day. I had exactly what I needed. I had exactly the people in my life that needed to be there. A card in the mail, a cup of coffee at a nurse's station, whatever it was, I got it. When my dad passed away, my son came and he brought the little baby with. She was 18 months old when they came back to Texas. And I got to form a relationship with that little girl that was beyond anything that I could have ever hoped for. After my son passed away, I allowed my daughter-in-law to put a big hook in me. And I played with that hook for a long time. She would pretend she would get mad at me, and I would be afraid that she would shut the door and I wouldn't get to see Sarah. And we played that game until 4 years ago. It took me that long to stop playing that game. And one day she started all that song and dance, and I said to her, we're not doing this anymore. I'm not doing it anymore. I'm done. No more money. No more anything. If you go, you go. And if you take Sarah with you, that's fine. She's a 23-year-old woman now. She can make her own decisions. And they left. And I haven't seen them for 4 years. And I grieved. Oh, my God, I grieved over that, you know. But I never was sorry. I saw my part in that, how you can allow somebody to manipulate you financially, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually until there's nothing left. And when I finally called my sponsor and I said, you know, this is what's going on. And I says, they're gone. And my sponsor, sometimes they're not very compassionate. She said, you know what, Beverly, she said, just be grateful. That daughter-in-law was a pain in the ass. Sorry for the language. But, you know, and I thought to myself, that's not even funny, but the fact is, what she was trying to tell me is that she had taken me for everything I had. I was giving it away to her, all of it. So that was part of it. Our son passed away in 93, and my granddaughter stood at the memorial service, and the room was filled with people that were from the program. Scott didn't have any friends, and you supported us. You didn't know he had AIDS. We had to cover that over. A lot of people figured it out, but we couldn't come right out and say what it was. Death certificates doesn't say died of AIDS. It's this failure, that failure, whatever, but it didn't say AIDS. And my granddaughter stood on a chair, and she thanked everybody for coming to her daddy's party. And my husband was upset with that, and he said, get her off the chair. And I said, it's okay. If it wasn't for Scott, I wouldn't be in Al-Anon. You wouldn't be sober. Steve wouldn't be sober. Stacy wouldn't be sober. We ended up taking Sarah to 13 years. We took her to the Crested Butte Mountain Conference in Crested Butte, Colorado. And she got to be Al-a-baby, Al-a-tot, Al-a-tween, Al-a-teen. She had 500 moms and dads. And a couple of years before she departed from my life, she had all four of her wisdom teeth pulled out. And she called me on the second day, and she goes, Nanny, I took those pills, those pain pills that the dentist gave me, and she said, I had an irrational reaction. And I said, really? What did you do? She says, I was mean. I didn't even know myself. I turned into a different person, and I was mean to my mom, and I was horrible. She said, do you think I have the black bean? Because that's what we always called it. You know, we called it. And I said, you know what? You're the only one who can make that decision. And she said, do you think I should never drink? And I said, that you're the only one that can make that decision. And she said, but if this happened to me with pain pills, it's probably going to happen with beer, right? And I said, could be. You know, and you taught me how to answer those kinds of questions. My oldest son got married, went through a divorce, ended up, you know, big to do with the kids and all, and now he's in Redmond, Oregon, and he's in a new relationship, and I have a step-grandson. So I lost one, and I got one. And that's the way God works. He fills all the voids. And sometimes we think, you know, but it's not Sarah. No, but it's Connor. And he thinks I'm pretty special. And then my niece moved in about a mile down the street, and I've got two of the cutest redheaded great nieces you could ever imagine, and they think Aunt Happy is the neatest lady in the universe. And the 16-year-old got her driver's license a couple of weeks ago, and I see this little white Kia pull up in my driveway on a rainy Sunday morning about a month ago, and out pops Gracie, and she says, "I got my driver's license, and I wanted you to see me drive." And she sat for 3 hours, and we had a cup of coffee, and we talked and had fun and laughed, you know, about her mom and dad's character defects and my character defects. And she's on the flag team or whatever you do when you dress up in those cute little uniforms for football and get out there at halftime. She does that and talked about all that stuff. And so, you know, I have a really wonderful life. I've got two golden retrievers. One of them was a registered service dog. I just didn't re-up it, but for 8 years I worked with dyslexic children at the Flower Mound Library in a program called Sit, Stay, Read, and the kids got to read to my dogs. And, you know, my husband is partially disabled. The COPD is a progressive disease, and I work an Al-Anon program harder today than I've ever had to, because sometimes when his oxygen stats get low, it's like if he's drunk. You know, he says things he didn't mean. He behaves mean and irrational, and then the oxygen level goes up and everything's fine. What's for lunch? And it's like, oh, my God. Oh, my God, not again. But I know how to take care of myself today. I get up at 6 o'clock every morning. I go out into the dark kitchen and start the Keurig, make myself a cup of coffee, and go and sit. I enclosed a little tiny area in my house, 7 feet by 13 feet. Sit there out there, drink my coffee. When the sun looks like it's just barely getting light outside, I get dressed and I take the two dogs for a 2-mile walk. I do it every day, unless it's raining. And so I have a ritual. Part of the word spiritual is ritual, which means you do the same thing over and over until it becomes a habit. And I have habits today that are good habits. They're wonderful habits. I go to meetings on certain days. I do certain things. I have some sponsees that call me at certain times, and I have a responsibility to not only work my program, or I would have nothing to give. So this is a continuous cycle for me, you know. But in it all, I have this wonderful life with all of the hardship. Grief took 5 years to get over, and it's not over. I cried over something probably 6 or 8 months ago. And, you know, so my son lives in my heart. He'll always be in my heart. He's always a piece of me. But you have books and you have literature and you have people who understand other people that have lost their children. We get to talk about how that feels. And this is such a wonderful spiritual community. And I can't even comprehend. I mean, I would have no life without you. I am so deeply grateful for everything that you have given to me. You keep coming back so you can feed me, and I'll keep coming back so I can feed you. And God bless you, and thank you so much.